Brothers, welcome back for another session of The Gentleman's Journey. I'm here with two very special guests today. We're doing a little bit of a different format. First and foremost, I'm here with Julian Emerson, Alpha Beta graduate, class of 80, and current sales manager at Colonial Life for the last 36 years. And I'm also here with John Boswell, class of 82 from Alpha Beta, and current COO for a nonprofit called Zoe Empowers, which we're going to hear all about later. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here today. I really do appreciate your time, and I do hope that we have some quality conversation today.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
So one thing I've started off with these past couple days, being at convention, the 180th convention, and just talking about how special it is. And obviously this is my first one, let alone as a delegate, so I'm getting to experience it. But you gentlemen have been familiar with convention for much longer than I have. Tell me about what it means to you. Julian, we'll start with you. Tell me about what convention has meant to you and what it really does for undergraduates and alumni together.
Well, thank you. Appreciate your letting me share some thoughts. This is this month is actually my 40th anniversary of my very first convention. Was an undergraduate at the University of South Carolina, finished there, started working for the National Fraternity in 1981, and the first convention that I attended was on staff, and it was in Evanston, Illinois, Northwestern University. And it was one of the more memorable experiences, as it turned out, of my life. Brother Boswell had driven up from South Carolina to join a large group, contingent of Alpha Beta brothers, and the convention banquet was filled with lots of great memories, and I thought, well, my goodness, if these are that much fun, I want to go to a lot of them. But I've enjoyed the 40 years since then. I think this is my 35th that I've attended in that period of time, so I hadn't been able to make all of them, not like Brother Haddendorf. But I enjoy it. It's a renewal, first of all, of family, fraternity, brotherhoods from the alumni that attend each year. It's also a way to meet new brothers that maybe it's their first convention or second as undergraduates. And I do consider the fraternity a family of a family fraternity, and it's a little like a family reunion. And each one has its own distinct characteristics based on we travel around to different schools, but also the things that happen there. The people, the young men, particularly the undergraduates that are there, they're different every year. A lot of the alumni come back year after year, but it's a very rich and fun and friendly dynamic, and usually you come away with a couple of good stories, and I've got plenty of those.
That's great. John?
Yeah. Well, I haven't been to nearly as many conventions as Julian. This is probably my 10th. But the very first convention I went to, the funniest single thing that's ever happened in my life happened at the convention in Evanston. And all of my close Chi Psi friends were there. So whenever we get together, inevitably, we retell the story. And we call it the Oliver Reagan Rowe slideshow story. And, you know, and sometimes things happen and you don't appreciate it at the time, although maybe this was so funny, maybe we did appreciate it. But you don't appreciate it at the time how it sticks with you for years and years and years.
Sure.
And so for me, getting together with friends that I don't necessarily see that often at convention is magical. And then for the undergraduates, I remember when I first came to my first convention, I mean, it's a big deal, you know? And you're brought in and you see your brothers from all over the country, and I think it's a special, special time.
You know, I agree. I really didn't know what to think when I first found out that I was going to get the opportunity to be a delegate. And just being here, just being able to meet, like, there's not one other opportunity where you're going to get to meet someone from just every Alpha, whether it's an alumni, an undergraduate. And I just think, you know, getting to be a part of it, delegate or not, is so, so special. And again, I know you said you've only been to 10. I know you said you've been to a few more, but I'm just looking forward to that in the future, getting to come back and experience something that's like fresh and new every year while still having everything you love from it. I mean, I'm sure it's been nostalgic at the same time, but it's definitely a one-of-a-kind experience, and I look forward to seeing, you know, where it takes me. So something we always start with, gentlemen, is basically when you get through your early life to college, what made you initially want to rush a fraternity? And moreover, what led you to Chi Psi specifically?
Well, my sister, who was 3 years in front of me at South Carolina, she was in a sorority, and she very much encouraged me to go into the Greek life. I, a friend of hers who was a junior at the time in Kaisai reached out to me in the summer and invited me to a summer rush party. And the gentleman of Alpha Beta treated me so well, and they were so friendly, and they were such a nice group of guys, and they and my whole a lot of my pledge class was at this, and I immediately bonded with these people, and I thought, my goodness, I'm going to come in to this sort of scary environment of stepping into a fairly large university, and I'm already going to have a network of friends and colleagues and people that I can rely on. It was the easiest decision I ever made.
I find that a lot of the men that I talk to, whether it's in this format or just catching up, say two very common things. That one, many of them weren't even looking to join a fraternity. Obviously, that's not your case, John, but they weren't looking to initially join a fraternity. And then when they did, and when they ended up joining Kaisai as a pledge and eventually a new member, a newly initiated brother, they say they never looked back. Best decision they've ever
absolutely
made. And that's really fantastic to hear from so many gentlemen. Julian, what about you, sir?
Well, my journey, so to speak, was very different than John's. And actually, he's 2 years plus my junior, younger than me. But he was one of the reasons that I joined Kaisai. I joined fairly late in my college career. I'm the first generation of my family to go to college. None of them had ever been in a fraternity. A couple of my brothers and sister, they went to USC, but they never joined a Greek organization. I didn't know much about them, honestly. But I was very involved with campus activities. I met brothers, future brothers, Mike Cowick and John Boswell, Atwell Coleman, through other organizations on campus. And going into my senior year, they kind of were bold enough to invite me to join as a senior, which was a very unusual. Most young men join fraternities early in their college career, and I considered it a real compliment that they would ask me to do that, because I wasn't going to have 3 or 4 years ahead of me to kind of give back to the organization. And I knew John through other organizations. I actually knew his sister. I was in school with her back in Florence, South Carolina, many years before that, but I didn't know him at that time. And they, a couple things appealed to me about Kaisai. First of all, I was late in my college career, so I kind of knew the difference between fraternities and which ones were kind of stood for something in terms of values. This brotherhood was an outstanding one at Alpha Beta at that time. They were gentlemen. It was a gentleman's fraternity. Mike Cowick identified Kaisai as a national fraternity. It was very small. We didn't want to be at all campuses. We were only, I think at that point, maybe 29 different schools around the country. That appealed to me. It spoke to that we just didn't want to be all things to all people. We wanted to be something to a very smaller kind of more special group, and it was a family fraternity, more of a smaller family fraternity. And being from a small town in rural South Carolina, all of those things meant something to me. And I knew the men for who they were and how they treated other people and how they treated each other, and all of that appealed to me. So I joined it, never knowing I would work for the National Fraternity a couple of years later. So I feel like Bill Haddendorf and others kind of took a chance on me there too. So. But the primary reason I joined is because of brothers like John that were in there, and just who they were as people. They meant something to me, and they stood for something other than let's throw down and have a good party. Now, we had a few of those too, as I remember of those parties. But
now, of course, just for those of you who don't know, Julian is the former chairman of the Kaisai Educational Trust. And again, just like many of our other brothers, has done a fantastic job, not only staying involved, but just being very adamant and taking initiative with this kind of thing. I feel like a lot of people in the undergrad experience in a more traditional fraternal culture, as they grow older, as they get closer to a senior, which is again when you joined, right, they kind of fizzle out. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to be involved. But what's so special about here is gentlemen are involved like well into their ages. I mean, so many of the men I've talked to have just told me they've been coming here for 40 years. They've been either volunteering, they've been holding positions, and they've been doing these things for so long.
Well, that turned out to be probably the best year of my life. Not only was it the best decision I've ever made because of the long-term friendships, worked for the central office for 2 years, traveled around the country, never had a chance to do that. But I mean, my goodness, if I had disengaged as a junior or senior, even in college, I mean, I can't imagine what I would have missed. So I would encourage folks to stay involved throughout, but you just don't know that one person, that one friendship that will last for a long time. And it could be a freshman or sophomore that you met when you're in the lodge that could introduce you to your spouse or get you a good job or, you know, send you into orbit like Jeff Bezos or something. You know, who knows?
That's topical. Very topical. You mentioned the lodge. In the lodge, it means something to every brother. You gentlemen know that. And though we all have different experiences with the idea of the lodge, it all holds similar value within us, and we all have experiences that we can share. What is the lodge to you guys? So, like, what do you think of when you think of the lodge? And tell me just about your experience at Beta, because obviously you guys have a notoriously beautiful lodge. Most people know that, and not just for a Kai Sai, for any organization, for any house by that standard.
We have the most beautiful lodge that neither Julian or I ever set foot in as undergraduates.
Of course, but you've seen it since.
Absolutely. Our lodge when we were undergraduates was a dorm room and
cement block,
old dorm university housing. Nonetheless, it was the center of our social and life. It was the center of the Beta experience, and I remember every time after going to classes, I was heading for the lodge, and because I knew that that's where my friends were, and I spent so many hours playing cards, and we used to just wrestle with each other, but it was the place that I knew that my friends were, and I couldn't wait to get there, you know. And the lodge isn't a building.
No, it's not.
And you know, we do have an amazing lodge, and I hope the young men at Beta now appreciate it as much as we appreciated this old dump that we lived in.
Well, it was, and all other 16 fraternities on campus had the same building, so they were, it was kind of like prison, but with a nicer tape. You could leave when you wanted to, I guess. But it was all bricks and cement blocks and steel and glass, and so it would not be, and there was no distinction between the fraternities, but I look at the lodge exactly the same way. Our building is beautiful at South Carolina today because of alumni who gave money that they knew they would never live in the building.
Right.
They gave it because they wanted the young men in the future to enjoy that beautiful physical. But I consider the lodge, it's the brothers that are in there. It's the human beings that are in there. It's the experience of the lodge, if you will. And I even like the history of the fraternity being, the Kai Sai was the first fraternity to ever have a fraternity building to gather, and it was a lodge out in the woods in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I even like, and I just hate it when people call their building or their brotherhood, you know, a house. It isn't, and it isn't a chapter, it's an alpha, it's a lodge. And that makes us unique as a national fraternity, and I think we should celebrate that and remember it. So,
I think, again, I mean, I've spoken about this before, but I just think that the idea of the lodge, whether you're currently an undergrad, an alumni, anything of that sense, is so special.
Mm-hmm. It is.
When I spoke to Brother Heil earlier, the first thing he told me was every time he walks in there, it's like he's 19 again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even if it's not the one you originally rent, when you just walk in there and see what's going on and like feel that experience, it's unreal. He described it as surreal, actually, and I would agree.
Well, when Brother Howe walks in here, he's 19 again. And when he walks, you know, I mean,
right. He walks into a restaurant.
He's 19. Yeah, exactly. So.
We'll just call it a special kind of 19. Okay, yeah. We'll just call it the specific college 19. So obviously, though you did join as a senior. You gentlemen both experienced a lot of stories, memories, you learned skill sets, things about yourselves while you were in the lodge, and, you know, when you joined this brotherhood that we've come to love so much. Talk to me about what you really took with you, what you deciphered and really took with you from that undergrad experience to where you gentlemen are today.
You want to start?
Sure, I will. I took with me confidence. Now, I've had pretty good self-confidence coming off of coming into school and coming from a very small town, and I had 54 people in my high school senior class. And my mother was a very confident person, not arrogant, but confident, and so she taught me about self-confidence. But I think what I took away from the Lodge is certainly the social skills and how to resolve conflict. Our alpha meetings were notorious for comments for the good of the alpha and critics and being critical, but not personally attacking someone, but how could the group be better?
Absolutely.
And so that was a very interesting experience for someone who'd never seen those kind of group dynamics. But the confidence through the friendships that were made, and brothers like John and Mike and Robbie Douglas, who was my big brother, and Robbie and I are still, well, all of those brothers I keep in contact with. But Robbie actually got me my first interview for a real job, not the fraternity job. In several years after college, and he and I were roommates in school, and then Robbie was an HR manager, but they were confident in me, and probably more than they should have been, in helping me to kind of find out who I was as a person. So that carried over into career work. The travel experience that I had with the National Fraternity helped me to feel more like I was connected to our country, if you will, but I think it was confidence for me is through these brothers and what they gave me, and they still do. But we have lots of stories and wonderful stories, and we still laugh at them. Probably nobody else would. We enjoyed them.
They're your inside jokes. They're inside stories.
We have lots of those.
That's good. John?
I think what I learned specifically from my undergraduate experience was the importance of being a gentleman. It was something that was emphasized. And it was uniquely emphasized at Chi Psi, unlike the other fraternities that were there. And to understand that you can be a gentleman and still have a good time and still enjoy partying and still, but you should carry yourself, you should treat women with respect, you should treat your friends with respect, you should carry yourself with dignity. And while I believe all those things, I think until I engaged with Chi Psi, it wasn't brought to front of mind. And that has carried with me since then, and something I've tried to instill in my own sons.
Speaking with, you know, Brother Hatnorf about the Chi Psi story, I mean, right when you get into those first couple chapters, as I'm sure you gentlemen know, it's how to be a gentleman. It's almost like it's an instruction book. It's what do we define as a gentleman? And I think, though oftentimes being a man is often constrained or put into a box these days, I think our fraternal brotherhood goes against that and says, you can enjoy these things, as you talked about, John. You can enjoy these things. You can be this person, and you can still be a man. You can still be a gentleman. And above all else, more than a gentleman, a good person. And I think that what we do goes way beyond our undergrad experience. It goes way beyond these events. We carry that out in the world, and in a time where Greek life is so scrutinized and such a bad place, generally speaking, that is, what is there than this time? Is there a better time than now to set a strong example as gentlemen, like we've talked about? So that's definitely something I think about, and I hope that the culture for Greek life can be turned, perhaps through us. So moving on into, I guess we're past graduation at this point. Tell me about getting into both your gentlemen's professions. I know you're a sales manager currently. I know you also pursued a JD and graduated with a law degree. And I know you now are the CEO for a nonprofit. What's our roadmap there? Let's start with you, John.
Well, and this is my career roadmap is integrally tied to Chi Psi. Mm-hmm. So when I graduated from undergraduate school, I went to law school, and I practiced law in Columbia for few years, Columbia, South Carolina, where USC is. And then I moved to Seattle, Washington, and I didn't know anybody in Seattle, Washington, except I knew a brother, Bill Holder. And I knew him through Julian, who knew him through his work in the national office. And so Brother Holder, not knowing me, invited me to come and live with him when I was moving out to Seattle to look for a job. Brother Chellis, who I didn't know except for the National Fraternity, who went to Michigan, he invited me to come and interview with his software company, and talked his boss, the president of the company, into hiring me. I didn't know anything about software. He talked them into hiring me to be the lawyer for a software company, which I spent, you know, studying and studying. Well, so fast forward, as a result of those introductions and going to Seattle, becoming hired into a software company, I then was hired by SAS Institute here in Cary, and spent the last 28 years working as a lawyer for a computer software company, and I rose to be the chief legal officer for a global software company. We had offices in 52 countries around the world, which allowed me to travel around the world and be involved in a lot of things that I would have never been able to be involved with, but for being a Kaisai and having a national brotherhood, and having people who didn't know me but knew that I was a brother and were willing to reach out. And that's I don't know if it's unique, but it is certainly a facet of Kaisai. You could break down in any, you could be on a road trip, break down in any state, in any city, and if you happen to know that there was a Kaisai there, you could call them and they would get up in the middle of the night, get in the car, come pick you up, bring you back, feed you, fix your car, get you, you know, have you a place to sleep and get you on the way, never having met you. And so that's how Kaisai has really been integral to my career. And so I spent that amount of time, and then just 2 years ago when I retired from the software industry, I then decided, well, I'm still a young man, I've got many years more that I want to work, and so I started working for this charity called Zoe Empowers. And so that's where I am now.
Before we move to Julian, do you mind talking to me a little bit about what Zoe Empowers is, what
sure.
they do?
Yeah. Zoe Empowers, we have a program where we take orphaned and vulnerable children in Africa and India. And there's about 58,000 orphans in our program right now. And we put them through a three-year program to transform them from being, you know, on the street to being entrepreneurs such that they should never need charity again. The traditional way that the West has dealt with charity is through relief and aid, which creates dependency. It sort of ruins local economies.
It's temporary.
It's temporary. Donors get frustrated because you're not making any progress. Well, we believe there's a different way, a better way. And so what we try to do is we try to invest in these people, in these young people, in a way such that we train them, teach them, empower them, give them micro grants and loans and training and, you know, et cetera, so that after 3 years, they don't need us anymore. They're on their own. And we count that as a tremendous success.
That's excellent. And I'm guessing that you guys have seen, you know, very good results.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Our data suggests that about 95% of the kids in our program after 3 years never need charity again.
And that is the way, again, despite traditional West thinking, I mean, this is the escape, this is the way. I mean, you can take it back hundreds of years. Education and getting people hands-on involved, teaching has always been a way to get people out of very poor or impoverished, oppressive situations. You can look back hundreds of years, and it's still true today. And I think if anything's up,
I don't know why this lesson has to keep being learned, or actually not being learned. But it is the way. And I, you know, the good news is I believe the world is turning and seeing that all of the billions of dollars that we've spent in sub-Saharan Africa and India, I don't want to say we've wasted it, because there, I mean, when there's a pandemic, I mean, not a pandemic, but a crisis, something like a famine or a flood or something where there is no food, you have to bring food. But for just long-term poverty, relief is more destructive than it is helpful.
And it seems like the work and the progress you guys are making is very promising, and I'm sure it'll continue to be if your dad holds true, which it seems
so.
Like it will.
I think it will.
So we went over John's profession. Now, Julian, you've worked with Colonial Life for about 36 years, if that's correct. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I can't believe it, first of all. It has been that long. It doesn't feel like it. Similar, in some ways, to John's story, after I worked for the fraternity for a couple of years, I moved back to Columbia. And Robbie Douglas, I mentioned Robbie, was my big brother in the fraternity. It was, again, one of the reasons that I joined Kaisai in the first place. Robbie had gone to work for a company, Colonial Life and Accident Insurance Company, out of Columbia, headquartered in Columbia, started there in the late 1930s. And he'd gone to work there in the HR department. They were looking to expand their marketing efforts and work more with insurance brokers and bringing in larger cases. And so in the marketing area of Colonial, they were looking for a couple of account managers, if you will. And I'd studied, I double majored in marketing and insurance at University of South Carolina. They had an insurance degree. And so that interested me very much. Now, Robbie couldn't give me the job, but he got me an interview. And the first time I interviewed with them, I didn't get that job. But then 6 months later, they called me back and went to work with Colonial in March of 1985. I had no idea I would stay that long. But again, it was through kind of the fraternity connections, if you will, didn't get me the job, but put me in a position to use my experience and skills and energy, I guess you could say. Left Colonial in 04 for a period of time, actually took about a year and a half off and just did kind of vagabond work around the world and around the country and did things that I'd never been able to do before. And then joined Aetna for a few years, so on the health insurance side, really didn't like that much, still sales management roles. But I'd been in Colonial, about half of my career has been in the home office, more on the corporate side, and about half has been on sales management. And I really enjoyed the sales management piece because I think you can be more results oriented and you can be a better teacher. And I think I'm more of a teacher than I am a rah-rah, you know, sure, motivational speaker like Chris Farley living down in a van
by
the river. Yeah, I'm not motivational as much as I am. I think I'm a pretty good student of the business, and I like to share that with others. I like to help the company to grow. I like to make money personally, and I like that the company is successful from a profitability standpoint. And that's kind of the dynamics. But I'd like to think of myself as more of a teacher and an educator for new people coming into the business to learn it.
Sure.
So it's a way to kind of give back. I enjoy that. It's been a great relationship. They've continued to pay me, and I've continued to produce for the company. And I really don't anticipate retiring. I've had a couple of sabbaticals in my career, and so there's not this long list of things that I want to do when I retire, and except spend more time with good friends and family and do the things that make life worth living, so to speak. But the fraternity has played, again, the things that I learned in the central office staff role as an advisor to alphas and who really maybe didn't want to see you coming around, but to offer advice and to build the confidence in me, but also a trust relationship. Those have all helped me tremendously in my professional career, being a very genuine person, try to be truthful. Everybody doesn't always like that, but I'm, you know, can be wrong at times, once or twice maybe, you try to do what's right, you try to do what's good for people, and I think that comes back to you. And sure, I learned a lot of that through the fraternity experience, both at Beta as well as the central office staff, and being around people who believe that too.
As far as ambitions go, did you always know that you wanted to do sales, or was that something you figured out along the way?
Not really. I mean, I just wanted to feel productive. I wanted to help others. I wanted to be with a business that did something good for folks. And I think the insurance industry, to me, that's been a good fit for me. It's not for everyone. And sales management was just kind of the vehicle that I took to accomplish those things.
Sure. You guys have highlighted a lot of high points both within the fraternity and within your occupations and things you've really just come to enjoy in this life. What would you consider to be some of your proudest moments or accomplishments? John, we'll start with you.
Let's see. Proudest moments or accomplishments? I don't think I can answer that question right now. Why don't let's let Julian answer it, and let me sure think about it for a second, because I'm stumped.
It's a tough one.
It's a tough one. I don't know that I had a proudest moment. My proudest accomplishments, and not in an arrogant way, are the friendships that have entered into my life, that I've been blessed with. I never take those for granted. I have been lucky. I've never married, so I don't have children, spouse and children to kind of point to say, well, that's my reason for living, I guess. But the friendships that have, I think, have been given to me, kind of entered into my life, I think have been my proudest accomplishments, I guess you could say, but they, those folks like John and others, they kind of found their way to me. I always thought that my mother used to tell me to if you're the smartest fellow in the room, you're in the wrong room. So keep finding smarter people. And I feel like that maybe through her prayers over the years that all these good men, you know, came in, and women and their spouses and things and the ladies of Kaisai, they've added a lot to my life, but I think it was those were gifts, honestly. So I consider those my most prized possessions, not in a glittery way, but they're my most proud moments, honestly.
It's the power of the brotherhood.
Yes, you know, it is.
I am very anxious and excited to see where that takes me. Mm-hmm. I've already gotten to meet so many great people in just, I mean, almost a year of being initiated coming this fall, and I just, you know, for gentlemen like you all who have been in it for decades and have gotten the pleasure to meet so many people.
Well, my wish for you is that you have even a better experience than we did, and it's been
it'd pretty be hard to do.
pretty darn good for us, even if you have a fraction of our experiences. And you talk about Brother Heil and Brother Ahlberg and Brother Hattendorf, all the and those that you had the pleasure of interviewing, and I would just suggest for you too personally, just take it and make sure that it fits into kind of who you are as a person, but then extend it on. And as long as you give it back to others when you get in a position of helping them, I think you'll benefit richly from it.
I remember the first thing I heard when I first joined, our number one looked at me and the rest of my pledge brothers now and said, "You will get out of this what you put into it."
I think that's true of everything in life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you reap what you sow. I mean, you can say it as many times as you
want to. Yeah.
Good or bad. Yeah. And I, again, you kind of just think that's one of those cliche things that you can just tell a group or tell someone ahead of something that's coming or an event. And you just forget that if you really do put in things into this fraternal brotherhood, you will get things out of it. And I would say most of the time, a considerable amount of the time, it's very positive, uplifting things. As your all's testaments have talked about, have we settled on?
Yeah. You know, why that threw me off is because I don't really think about that very much. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to think about the future and not really what's happened in the past.
Of course.
But having had a second to reflect on it, professionally, probably the my most proud accomplishments were the ability to, in the European Union, influence some legislation through my advocacy that, although most people wouldn't appreciate it, the general data privacy regulations were very restrictive on American businesses. And I was able to make some changes to that legislation that had a huge impact on the American economy that I don't think anybody would ever know about it,
of course.
And the same thing here in North Carolina, we had some legislative issues that I had to address that have been hugely impactful for businesses, but you know, it wasn't anything anybody ever knew about. I knew about it, the people I worked with knew about it, but sometimes the best work is done if it's not publicized.
Of course.
And then on a personal level, and this goes really back to the fraternity and the relationships, I have maintained a core group of friends for over 40 years. And, you know, I have a lot of acquaintances, and I have a core group of really close friends, Julian being, you know, first amongst them. And I have managed through all my life, my ups and downs, and being married and having kids and everything else, to maintain those relationships. And so if anybody ever asked me for, you know, like advice, I would say find 3 or 4 or 5 people that you share values with, and I'm talking about men. I think men uniquely can relate to one another, but find 3 or 4 or 5 men that you really love and you share values and that you care about, and hold on to them through your life. And I've managed to do that, and that's been a huge accomplishment for me.
Sure, and you did mention that your mindset is more future-oriented more than past, which is a very healthy mindset to have at times. I do think a big defining factor of our lives, though, is failure, is a setback. And I think that type of, that level, that magnitude of vulnerability is what binds a lot of us together, the fact that we're not perfect. No matter how much we strive to be quality men, quality gentlemen. We're not going to do it always well along the way. There's going to be times where we really learn something. So I'm hesitant and reluctant to use the word failure, but what's a setback or a lesson that you really took to heart early on that has made you who you are now?
Well, you mean, I'll start with that. Since I punted on the element, I'll let you think about it for a minute. You know, and I'll say this, and this is personal. I failed in my first marriage, and that created a lot of heartache. It created a lot of heartache for me. I had two children through my first marriage, created a lot of heartache from them. They probably still suffer from it. And the mistake I made was I realized before I ever married that I was making a mistake, and I did not have the courage to stop the marriage before it happened. And then I paid for that and still pay for that. And I was a young man, and had I had more courage and been willing at the very front to say, you know what, I'm sure this isn't the right relationship for me to get into. I'd already asked this woman to marry me, and I was not man enough to step away from that. And so I sort of took the easy way out at that point in time, and I paid for it for many, many years, and still do today because of you know, the challenges that that's brought into my life and my children's lives, et cetera. And so I consider that a failure, but I have to say this man was here. He was in my first wedding. He was at my second wedding, you know, but he helped me through all of that. And that's where I was talking about earlier, having a core group of people that you really can lean on in the tough times, and Julian is certainly one of them.
I think that's what's beautiful about this whole thing is, regardless of, you know, what you categorize as failure or setback, you have redemption, reconciliation, friendship, brotherhood, family.
Honesty.
Yeah. And ultimately, in the end, again, you gentlemen are older than myself and you have done more life than me, but you end up yielding something from it. And while it's not always exactly for the better, it's something that you can remember and look back to. And I think you would say that's definitely something you look back to as you continue on in your life, sir.
Well, it certainly has. I mean, it's certainly a lesson that I have learned.
Absolutely. A good one at that.
Failures, to me, I can't really think about it that way. I fail every day. I have human emotions. Every day is not roses and champagne. I'm a flawed human being. I am a possessive person. I hold grudges. Well, I try not to hold grudges, but I have a hard time forgetting things when friends of mine have been wronged, particularly even more so than me. I'm a typical Scorpio, as my mother would have indicated. So I'm a flawed person. So I consider those kind of failures. I consider things with work and other aspects of my life. I don't think you failed unless you quit, because I think you truly, that sounds cliche as well, but you just, okay, did you learn something? Would you do things differently? And then try to do it differently. So even the event or something that some folks may consider a failure, even a relationship, and John very openly discussed with his first wife, but it wasn't all bad, and good things came out of that. He learned, he had two sons as a result of that marriage, and there's a lot of love there and support and the things that he learned about himself, but his two sons. So I don't know, maybe a personal view, I don't consider those failures as much as I do. Did you learn something from it? And if you do the same thing again over and over, then that's kind of, I might need to help you with insanity definition.
Sure.
Okay. But so it's how I look at it. I'm sure others could probably pick to lots of things that I've failed at. But I try to learn something from it, and even the fraternity, because we've made a lot of mistakes over the years at the national level and in my time with the fraternity. But I'd say, well, did you learn something from it? Can you get better, grow as a person, and kind of recognize your frailties, your human frailties, which we all have those. I work on those every day, still do. It's just kind of part of my DNA, but thank goodness John and others, they do love me still, despite, and he knows everything I just got through saying, he probably knows that better than most anybody else in the world. But he mentioned love, and I know this sounds kind of sappy, but he and I have always, even as young men, we never shied away from telling each other that we love one another. Mm-hmm. We still do it on phone calls. We don't see each other that often, but we try to often enough, although we're several hours away from each other. But to me, it's a wonderful sharing, but I think it's a sign of strength, but not in a manly way as much as it is. We've never hesitated in letting that emotion be something that has ever stood in the way of being good friends and brothers, I might add, because I consider him more of a brother than my biological brothers, because I had no control over who they were, and I love them, but I don't like them as much as I do him.
Family is, again,
it takes a lot of energy to be in a family.
It does, and it's not really something you can choose, but you can choose who you consider to be family.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure that's how you gentlemen will describe each other. So just getting into these last 2 years, you have a lot of men, obviously, every year graduating from this fraternity, becoming alumni, getting out into the job world, and you both two very professional men, two men who have worked in different industries for a long time, but held very high positions, know that professionalism is a really big deal in today's world, and setting yourself out when it comes to, you know, resumes, interviewing, it's very integral. What would be each of your gentlemen's number one tips for someone going into a job interview or pursuing a career when trying to stand out or really be appealing as a new hire for a company?
So I have interviewed hundreds of people over my career all over the world. And the thing that separates people I'm willing to hire from people I'm thinking, gosh, if I got to sit here for another 30 minutes during this interview, because in the first 2 minutes I knew I'm not going to hire this person, is whether someone is prepared. If you think about it this way, when I am looking to hire somebody, I want to know if this is somebody that I can, you know, that I can give a project to or send to represent me, and they're going to represent me well. They're going to do a good job. What's the first way that I know that? Did they come into this interview prepared? And so, do they know everything that you can know about the company or the firm? Do they know, have they done research on you? Have they done research on the products? Have they done research on what's the latest announcement? Have they shown initiative? Do they ask good questions? I actually teach a little mini course on this very topic. Now, I'll give you an example. One time, this happened more than once. I've asked someone, I said, well, you know, I'm really glad that you're here. You know, what makes you come in? And then someone would say, oh, I've always wanted to work at SAS. At that point in time, in my mind, the interview is over. We don't call ourselves SAS. If you don't know we call ourselves SAS, you haven't done one lick of you know, research and preparation. You know, this interview is over. Oh man, I got to sit here for the next 30 minutes and listen to you collaborate. There's no way you're getting this job. However, someone who comes in and I say, well, you know, do you have any questions? And they say, well, you know, I do. In effect, I wrote them down because I wanted, you know, an interview is a nervous time for me. I want to make sure I don't forget any. So they start asking me insightful, good questions. I'm thinking, oh, this is somebody who came into this interview prepared, thoughtful, ready to go. So my number one advice for anybody who's coming in into an interview is be prepared and have good questions. And your questions cannot be about what the company can do for you. They have to be about what you can do for the company.
Excellent. Julian?
Well, I think Shakespeare, maybe it was in Hamlet, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm not a particularly well-read person, but I think there's a line in Hamlet that readiness is all. So to John's point, I think prepared and readiness, be ready. I'll add a couple more things about professions, and I've interviewed lots of folks over the years too, that's for sure, for a lot of different kinds of positions. I would say being authentic, being yourself, being comfortable, a young brother from Yale a couple of years ago asked me, and he was number one, and then he later became student body president at Yale, so he's very, very bright and very capable young fella. And I was kind of, I was very surprised that he would care to ask me a question, because he's a lot smarter than I am, that's for sure. But he asked me, he said, well, Brother Julian, he called me, he said, what would you consider the most best skill of a successful salesperson? And lots of folks would think about, oh, they're able to present products, and they're able to talk, and they sure talk funny, and they're or talk pretty, or all that kind of, they look good, you know, smell good, clean up. And I said, actually, I think the best salespeople I've ever met were good at asking, they asked good questions. The best salespeople I've ever met, they ask good questions. That kind of turns it around a little bit from what people think about as being a sales, but that means they've done their homework, they've been prepared, but also they ask good questions to find out what you might need. And what they have, they may not need you, so be willing to accept that too. That's part of the authentic part. So I'd say in an interview process, just be yourself, be authentic. Don't try to rush, don't try to push. If it's not a good fit, it isn't a good fit. Even if you get hired, you usually find out later that wasn't the right decision for either party, either the business, and it's got to be good for both. And I think an interview should be both ways. They should be asking me questions to figure out if this is a good fit for them, because they should know who they are better than I would in an interview process.
Sure, and I think that's, again, just becoming more and more prevalent as we enter, you know, into a more technologically advanced world every day. You have people, even through, as you know very well, just from COVID, and the introduction of Zoom interviews, all these different things, it is difficult at times to really stand out. It is difficult to appear as if you can actually be of service to someone when you're interviewing so many people and they have to hear so many people at once. And I definitely think those are things that you definitely need to consider when going in there. And I definitely think that these gentlemen listening will consider. So, gentlemen, I got one more question for you, and then we'll let you be on your way.
This is like the final question?
And it's a silly one.
Silly.
Per tradition.
With that. Okay.
Does pineapple belong on pizza?
Oh, wait.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Two absolutes?
Oh, no question. My favorite pizza.
With the ham.
Yeah,
a little thin slice of ham, prosciutto with the, it could be prosciutto, yeah.
Well,
I'm hungry. I haven't had lunch. You want to go get some lunch?
Let's go get some pizza.
I'm always
enjoy me.
So, since you don't have lunch,
great to be with you.
This has been Brother John Boswell and Brother Julian Emerson. We thank you for being here with us today, and we will see you guys next time. Have a great rest of your week, and God bless.